You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, China is Africa's largest trade partner. Both Republicans and Democrats suspect Beijing is up to no good. It's invested billions in the continent, and some fear that's left many countries in debt to a new imperial power. So what is China getting for that money? Jen White and her guests answer your questions today at 6 on 1A+. Now, clutter is big business in the United States. There are services that help us clean up and get organized or to deal with all our possessions after we leave them behind. And it's big in pop culture, from shows like Tidying Up with Marie Kondo that make the case for getting rid of things that don't spark joy, to shows like Hoarders that look at clutter when it's taken to the extreme. But those all deal with clutter that we already have. Our next guest says we need to look at the causes of clutter and what leads us to get so many things in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your relationship with clutter and stuff? Do you have a horror story to share, your own, or maybe cleaning up for a relative, a success story? Did you change your attitude about buying stuff to have less clutter in the first place? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer Howard is a Washington, D.C.-based writer and editor. Her latest book is called Clutter, An Untidy History. Jen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be here.
Well, you open the book with a story about your mother and going through her home and her stuff. Can you talk about what you went through and why that inspired you to seek out more of the history of clutter?
Sure. Well, like a lot of us, I found myself actually very suddenly in the position of having to clean out my mother's house after she had a mental and physical breakdown. She went from overnight living in her house that she'd been in for 50 years to not being able to be there at all. It just wasn't safe. So it felt to me as an only child to go in and try to make some sense of everything that she had. You know, I had to deal with her papers, her finances, all the medical care, but then I had this house full of stuff. And I was shocked and overwhelmed by how much stuff my mother had managed to accumulate in all that time. I knew she was not a minimalist, but I didn't realize, until I actually had to deal with everything in there, just how much she had. And that got me interested sort of as a survival mechanism trying to understand what was happening and how my mother, and as it turns out, so many other people, wound up in this really, really difficult situation.
And you dug back into history and you find we're not alone in the United States with clutter and having lots of stuff. But you kind of trace the history here in the U.S. back to Victorian England, when we start to have a different relationship with being able to buy lots of stuff and wanting lots of things. What kind of things did you find out?
Oh, it was fascinating. I could have written multiple books on the Victorians alone. I was hoping I could find a starting point for clutter, like the historical moment when clutter was born. And I couldn't really trace the moment, but there was so much in the Victorian era that resonated for me as a 21st century American, the kind of love of things and the love of having nicely furnished houses and all the stuff we can buy and the message that we get to, you know, that we should be buying things, should be buying more. The Victorians would have been very familiar with all of that. When you look at the Industrial Revolution and, you know, the ability to make more things more quickly and ship them to people, with the rise of cities, with department stores, all these things kind of started to coalesce as I was reading and looking around for me in the Victorian era. And you think about the Crystal Palace, the famous huge glass showcase, basically, of the London Exhibition in 1851. That really became a touchstone for me for this modern phenomenon of clutter. And I really felt it was very, very much an important starting point for that.
I mentioned earlier the TV show Hoarders. There are others that look at, you know, when collecting stuff really goes to an extreme. A big point in your book, though, is those shows sometimes treat the hoarder as this sort of individual pathology. You kind of see it, correct me if I'm wrong, you see it as a symptom of a wider attitude toward consumerism and our desire to have and keep stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, of course, personal choice and personal habits and sometimes mental challenges can really contribute to this problem. But, you know, from the minute we're born, we are steeped in this culture of buy, buy, buy. You know, you think about if you've ever been to a baby shower or that anything, really anything you do in modern life involves, often it seems to involve the message that you should buy something. And that's what you should be doing as a good consumer and all that. And it's very hard for individuals to escape the power of that message. As I said, it starts when we're kids, and we're surrounded by advertising and by big box stores, and now online, e-commerce, Amazon. It's so easy to buy, and as I saw with my mother, I think she got trapped in this web of consumerism, and once you're stuck in it, it can be very, very hard for people to get out of it just through force of individual will alone.
Talking to Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like there's a lot of clutter in your life? What leads you to buy stuff, bring you into your home? What challenges do you have when it comes to getting rid of stuff? Do you know someone who you've seen it go pretty far with bordering on hoarding things? What changed? Was there something that made them change their ways? Call in with your thoughts, experiences, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jennifer, you just mentioned sort of the emotional connection we have with things. And I'm not a hoarder. I kind of go back and forth. I just purged a bunch of kids' drawings from their little. And I go back and forth between, there's a smudge on this paper that a kid might have made. Got to keep it forever, to this ruthless paring down. But I get the emotional investment in a thing. There's a memory connected with why we have it in the first place that I can understand people being reluctant to let go of. Talk about the emotions at the center of this.
That's really at the heart of it. That is what makes it, I think, so hard for so many of us to get rid of things, because we do have personal connections. And, you know, if grandma gave you something, or the little thing you brought back from the sea, your beach trip with the kids, and you feel like you're throwing away the vacation if you throw away the object, it's really hard. And if every object or many of them have that kind of some kind of emotional baggage with them, no wonder it's hard to get rid of them. I mean, if you have to stop and process all those feelings, those memories, it's overwhelming. And it's easy, again, since we are a society that really does value things, we sometimes conflate the thing with the person or the memory, and it's very hard to kind of extricate yourself from that. The kids' artwork, everything your child ever touched is valuable, or feels like it, but it's hard to actually sort of get yourself to do the process of sorting and deciding what's really important, what's enough, and what's too much.
A lot of our efforts, and a lot, I think, businesses make money off of this, they go toward the back end. We have the clutter. We have the stuff. How do we organize it? How do we sort it? How do we purge it? Whatever. What kind of things are you thinking about when it comes to the front end, whether we bring a thing into our house in the first place and how we curate it before it becomes cluttered in the first place?
That's the thing. If you can head it off at the pass, that's the way to go. It's very hard because we're in a society that gives us freebies and sends, everything comes in a bag and a package. And you go to if you go out to a hotel, you come home with all these little shampoos and conditioners. It's free. Why not? Maybe it'll be useful. And it's so, but you really have to take that early step of saying, do I really want this? Do I really need it? Is it just going to take up space in my medicine cabinet or my closet or my kitchen cupboard? All those sauce packets that you get if you get takeout, takeout food. And when you start looking for opportunities to say no to things, you realize there are a lot of them, and it doesn't seem like it would make that much of a difference, but over time it really does. And it's, saves you time, saves you the energy of having to try to figure out what you're going to do with it down the road. Bigger purchases too. Do you really need more clothes? Shop your closet first. There are things you can do that really will help address the clutter problem and be more economical and also just better for the environment and society in general.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Mozaki. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I am an artist. My husband sort of considers me a hoarder. He can get through my house and my dishes are clean, but I paint and I quilt and I draw and I sew and I have canning stuff I've got stuff. I've probably got 5-6 times what the average person has, but it's because I do all of these things. I have trouble finding homes for things, permanent places to put them. and I have difficulty with storage. But if, you know, and but I worry, I'm getting a little bit older, and I worry about something happening to me, and then what's whoever's left taking care of it going to do with all of it?
Have you thought, Lisa, or have you looked for ways to curate a purge? And I know it might be hard, but deciding that some stuff has to go, even if it doesn't find a home?
Yes, I've actually pared down some of the things that I've done. Like, for instance, I can do probably 100 different crafts, but I've decided that, you know, maybe 5 of them are what I'm really interested in, and I've tried to let the rest of it go. But I have to bring myself back to that regularly, because my set point is to try to do everything.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your story. And Jennifer, that reminds me, this is that the thing where somebody we might look at and say is a hoarder, which we'll talk about that word in a bit, but also they might be an artist. There's a lot more to their story than that, as we just heard from Lisa.
Sure, absolutely. No, that really resonates with me. And, you know, if you're using your things and appreciating them, they're not really clutter, I don't think. I mean, clutter is chaotic, it's messy, it's kind of deprives it makes the things not really useful in the way they are. And it sounds like for someone like Lisa, who's actively creating and using things, you know, maybe there's sort of a, she can sort of think of her excesses. There might be other people out there who could use things, or she could kind of help circulate things. I don't know. It's I think there are some ways to make it less, make the amount of stuff seem less overwhelming. And if you're thinking about it in the first place, that's huge. That is I think it really sets someone who can handle their stuff apart from people who are just lost entirely in all their stuff.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your story. We're talking to writer Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story about clutter in your life, your relationship with your stuff, your kid's stuff, your parents' stuff, maybe, call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with writer and editor Jennifer Howard about her latest book, Clutter, An Untidy History. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Marcus on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Rob. So my great aunt and uncle used to have a little wooden plaque in their house that said, creative clutter is far superior to idle neatness, and I completely agree. As for like what the guest was talking about before with, or you were saying with kids' pictures and stuff from the beach and whatever else, I like to do art in my free time. And so I started taking with my kids, we'll sit down and go through their pictures from school and whatever else. And then some of the stuff we may have picked up, rocks or shells or whatever at the beach. And then we try to either get a board or a shoebox or something, make some sort of diorama or some sort of other creation out of pictures that they pick. So that way they're having to kind of choose and go through like why they like this one or why I like this one. And then we kind of create something new. So then you add an extra layer of memory on top of it. And it's a great way to use up some of that stuff.
Interesting, Marcus. Thanks so much. What it's kind of shopping at home, Jennifer, and creatively repurposing the stuff that's around instead of just, I guess, storing it somewhere.
Yeah, no, that's lovely. I mean, that really shows you that objects can have a meaningful role in your life. You know, there's an active choice there to, and it gets, I love that Marcus is getting his children to think too about what matters to them and what they're, you know, how they can kind of work their important things into their lives instead of just having stuff pile up around them and not be appreciated. I think that's great.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that. Could have used that probably 15 years ago. We'll go next to Jamie in Middleton. Jamie, hi.
Hi, this is Jamie. I was just speaking to my parents are moving out of the house we grew up in, and so they've been there for 30 years, and their professions are a former art teacher and construction worker, and so with those careers come a lot of stuff. So we're finding it tough to get rid of and want to be mindful of how to recycle and not waste, but 30 years can be quite the accumulation.
Yeah. And now, Jamie, is there a sense that, hey, some of this stuff, I mean, construction worker, art teacher, they're going to have stuff that might be useful to somebody? Is that part of the stumbling block that they want to make sure they're not wasting something that somebody can make use of?
Yes. And obviously, it's a passion of both of theirs. And a lot of a lot of heart goes into the work, so you know what things are worth and all the different ideas you have with it. So yeah, definitely want to recycle and reuse and give it to someone else who might find use, but quite the process if it's not something you kind of keep up with and sort through as you go.
Jamie, thank you so much for sharing that. This is something, Jennifer, that a lot of people have been through, you to some extent with your mom's stuff. Like, some of this is going to end up in landfill, but maybe some of this has sentimental value for somebody. Waste not, want not. Maybe somebody could use this stuff. How much could that lead to keeping the clutter?
Well, I think that is a big part of it. People think, well, it's, you know, it's perfectly good. I don't want to throw it out, you know, and it could be useful someday. And the truth is, most of the time, it's not going to be useful. And if you really need that thing, you can probably borrow it or get it again. But the idea is it's much easier to let go of things if you can rehome them and you know that they're going to be used. They're not going to wind up in a landfill, especially when, as Lisa was describing, there are things that, you know, have to do with how you spend a lot of your life, your career, your family. And it takes a lot of work to do that kind of rehoming and donating. But if, especially living out of family house and try to help your parents deal with all of their things, it probably is worth the time if you can take the time, even though it is harder. You don't want to just pull up a dumpster and, you know, throw it all away. It's much easier to try to, ultimately it's more emotionally satisfying to let it go when you know it's going to have another life.
Thanks again for that call. Good luck to your parents as they make those decisions. We are talking to Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter and Untidy History. Back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Kewaskum. Dave, hi.
Hey, yeah. So like that caller Lisa before, my dad was an artist growing up. So he always collected a bunch of what people call junk, you know, plastic tubes, stuff like that. And they always sort of rode that line of being hoarders. And then one day, between health issues and they got hold of that Marie Kondo book, they just went through and threw out everything. And they were very satisfied. They're very happy with where they are right now. But in the process, they threw out a lot of, you know, family heirlooms and stuff that was significant to the family. And we never really got an opportunity to go through it with them and point out what we would like to keep. And that sort of left an open wound in the family.
Wow. Dave, thanks for sharing that. I mean, did you come to terms with that? Did you talk to them about that, find out other ways to keep memories without the object?
Not really. I mean, we managed to salvage some family photos, but that's still sort of an ongoing thing.
Wow. Dave, thank you for sharing that. Jennifer, maybe this is another extreme. I don't know. Some people did want the stuff that was gotten rid of here.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a balance. You know, I think... especially when it's not just your stuff, but it's your family history, which especially with a family house, you know, and your parents have, I just went through all my elementary school papers that my parents had saved. And, you know, at least I got to make the decisions about that and got to relive some of the highs and lows of my, you know, my childhood. And I regret, one thing I really regret with my mother is that I didn't have a chance to sit down and hear her stories about her stuff. You know, I was flying in the dark basically when it came to what was important to her, or who this person in this photograph was, and it's a loss, you know. As the caller was just describing, it's almost like everything got taken away from you in a fire or a flood. You know, to have no say in how your what parts of your history you get to save, that's really traumatic. And ideally, if you have relatives who are downsizing, they will give you a chance to, you know, hear their stories and help you. Or you maybe let you help them make some choices about what to say and what might be meaningful to future generations. Because once that stuff is gone, it's gone.
Thanks, Dave, for sharing that with us. Sherry joins us now in Amherst. Sherry, hi.
Hi. My husband and I taught internationally for 32 years. And we traveled, and everywhere we went, we'd collect things. And then we'd come home and we'd store them away. And then we go to another location. And so now that we've retired, we've unpacked all this stuff. And we have a very cluttered house with stuff, beer steins, paintings from China, paper cuts, teapots, Saudi Arabian coffee pots, porcelain, and beer steins. And it goes on and on and on. And I'm trying to, and our children aren't interested. And so I'm trying to figure out where I could have these things settled, because it's not like something you would get at a thrift store, I don't think. course, my treasures. So I would love to know where I could actually take some of the stuff, because some of it is antiquities.
Sherry, thanks for the call. And this has got to be a common question. I bet a lot of people bring it up to you, Jennifer. This stuff is too good to just give away, but I don't know what to do with it.
Oh, it's so common, especially as with a lot of family furniture and things like that. And it sounds like the caller has a lot of interesting stuff collected from around the world. Honestly, it's good to be realistic about whether people really want to pay money for your things if you don't have family members who want them. A lot of people do have success with estate sales, and you don't have to die to have an estate sale. You can have a downsizing sale, and there are companies that will actually work with you, and they do take a percentage of the profits, but they can come in and they kind of look at what you have and put prices on it and advertise the sale. That could be potentially a useful option in that case. But sometimes you just have to let it go too, and to know when it's too much effort to try to sell it, and it's better to just find it a new home.
Well, thanks for all of your calls today, and Jennifer, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show, and I loved all the calls. So many good stories.
Yeah. Jennifer Howard is a Washington, D.C.-based writer and editor. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called Clutter, An Untidy History. Still time for you to share your story, your thoughts on clutter in your own life or that of people you know. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if new revenue projections hold up, Wisconsin is going to have a budget surplus approaching $3 billion. We'll take a look at what Governor Evers and state Republicans want to do with the extra money. First, in 2018, former President Donald Trump signed a bipartisan criminal justice reform bill into law. It was known as the First Step Act. It was designed to reduce recidivism and long prison sentences. Fast forward to now, and thousands of people in federal prison are slated to be released early under that law. But a tool being used by the Justice Department to help figure out who gets released early may be leading to some biased results. We're taking a closer look at that story and talking about the role of technology in the criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support reforms to reduce the length of prison sentences for some offenders and to lower the overall prison population? And then how do we decide who can be released early and who can't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Carrie Johnson is a national justice correspondent for NPR. Carrie, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Oh, happy to be there. Thank you.
Can you remind us of the basics on the First Step Act? What was it? What did it set out to do?
Yeah, lawmakers from both political parties came together to overwhelmingly pass this law. The first thing it did was to lessen the penalties, lessen the sentences for certain kinds of drug crimes, and give judges more discretion. And the second thing it did was basically create an algorithm to assess the risk of people already in prison and to give people who were low and minimum risk the chance to take programs inside prisons that would help them reenter society. And if they took those programs, they'd get credits and be able to get out early. And my reporting found that there were fundamental flaws with that last system, with that risk assessment tool, that it was plagued by human error and math errors and even racial disparities.
Can you talk about this algorithm being used by the Justice Department? It's called Pattern. What do we know about what goes into Pattern to assess this kind of risk?
Yeah, there's been three versions of Pattern. It's been plagued by problems all along. Analysts say it's gotten a little bit better, a little bit more accurate in terms of avoiding some of those kind of bungled human errors and math errors. But even so, in this new version of Pattern, 14,000 people inside federal prisons were still misassessed and will need to be reassessed. They were put into the wrong risk categories. Among the factors that go into this, inputs that go into this tool, are things like criminal history and other factors that people say could be racially biased, in part because, as we know, police sometimes have a greater presence and conduct more arrests in Black and brown communities than they do in white communities. And so some of the inputs in this system were already kind of suspect, according to analysts. And as a result, it's producing some racial disparities where it's over-predicting the risk that some Black, Hispanic, and Asian people in prison would return to crime or break new rules if they left prison. And that's a problem.
Carrie, if I'm in federal prison and this algorithm says, yeah, Rob is low risk, what does that mean for me? What kind of systems do I get into that can lead me ultimately out of prison?
Yeah, Rob, this means that you would be able to get credit for working a job inside prison, building furniture or doing some other kind of work, that you would get credit toward early release for taking a drug rehabilitation program, for taking life skills classes, for taking college-level classes online as a kind of correspondent student. All of those things would build up into your account and would allow you to get out of prison early. The problem is that these risk categories are a little bit all over the place, and there are also some racial disparities leading some Black and brown inmates to not be eligible in the first place, because only people who are low in minimal risk are allowed to participate in this programming and get credit to get out early.
Talking to Carrie Johnson, national justice correspondent for NPR, looking at a change in federal law. This happened a few years back. It gives a pathway for some federal prison inmates to get out of prison, but concerns, as we're hearing, that the algorithms, the systems used to say whether one person is too high a risk to participate in this, to get out, maybe flawed. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carrie, I think whenever we're using an algorithm, the hope is that this is going to somehow be an unbiased and impartial alternative to letting a person, a parole officer or a parole board or whatever it might be, make these decisions with their own individual biases. Are people giving up hope for that now?
They're not exactly giving up hope, but they're pointing out that these risk tools like Pattern, these algorithms, are dependent on the people who create them and what they decide is important and what counts. And so the goal of people like Melissa Hamilton, a professor, a law professor at the University of Surrey, who I consulted for my piece, is to reduce the disparities to an extent that it seems to be more fair to use this algorithm than to have people with all kinds of unconscious bias make these decisions.
Now, outside groups are pointing to this, and as you mentioned, some law professors and others. Is the Justice Department saying, yeah, even with this third version of Pattern, we still need to make changes?
Yes, they are. Attorney General Merrick Garland has directed a team at the Justice Department to try to reduce these disparities, fix some of these issues, make this tool more transparent for people who want to conduct independent research, all with an eye toward developing a new and better version of this tool. It's going to take a while. And remember, 14,000 people inside federal prison were put into the wrong category. So the Bureau of Prisons has to reassess all those people in prison once they come up with a new tool.
And when you say put into the wrong category, is it always somebody who should have been low risk was said high risk so they can't get out? Or does it go the opposite direction sometimes, too?
Yeah, that's what's so confounding about these problems. They go both ways. In some cases, the tool overpredicts the risk of a return to crime. In other cases, it underpredicts. And that is really confounding for researchers. They've got to wrap their arms around this, in part because people's liberty, people's freedom is tied to this tool. So it has important real-life consequences for thousands and thousands of folks.
Now, this was passed again back in 2018. Are we at a stage now, Carrie, where people are actually walking out the prison door now?
Actually, last month in January, people started to leave prison early because of these credits and the way the Justice Department and the Bureau of Prisons were allocating them. At this point, we think several thousand people have left over the last few weeks. The problem or the challenge is that some of those decisions may have been affected by the biases in this tool. So it's not at all clear to lawyers who defend some of these folks and advocates who watch all of these issues from a civil rights perspective that this was really a fair process.
Now, this is a federal program involving federal prisons. As I understand it, Carrie, most inmates in prison in this country are in state prisons. Are people at the state level, as far as you know, looking at this as a possible model or else cautionary example for their own systems?
In fact, members of Congress at the federal level got some of these ideas from advancements in the states. Some of these ideas have already been put into place in states, and in the criminal justice system across many states, their use of risk assessment and other algorithms. The problem is this is the first time the federal government has tried to do this and tie it to people's liberty, the ability to leave prison early, and they didn't do such a good job. They're trying, but it still doesn't seem quite right.
What are you watching for next as the Justice Department continues to, I guess, tweak this system?
I think that there are some people out there, including the ACLU, the Sentencing Project, and the federal public defenders, who believe the Justice Department should just pause the use of this tool, that there's really no way to fix some of these fundamental flaws, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on senior Justice Department officials to pause or scrap this pattern algorithm altogether in the months and years ahead.
If the algorithm is scrapped, does that kill the whole First Step Act then, effectively?
No, the reforms that were intended to lighten the prison sentences for people convicted of new crimes, like drug-related crimes and nonviolent offenses like that, would continue as part of the First Step Act. And importantly, the First Step Act allowed people in prison who are really in dire circumstances in terms of being sick to petition courts directly for compassionate release. That program has allowed at least 300 people in prison to leave during the pandemic, and that would continue too.
Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Carrie Johnson, National Justice Correspondent for NPR. She was with us today to talk about racial biases in a Justice Department tool meant to determine eligibility for early release for federal prisoners. Up next, we'll talk to a Wisconsin expert about how risk assessments work and hear about the upsides and downsides of risk assessment technology. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the use of risk prediction technology, these algorithms we've just been hearing about in the criminal justice system, determining who might be eligible to get out of prison earlier? Do algorithms and data have a place in determining who gets released early from prison or who has to stay in jail before a trial? If you've encountered these systems, the criminal justice system, as a defendant, inmate, parolee, or you work in the system, love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about the role of risk assessment in the criminal justice system and why new technology used for risk assessment can lead to biased results. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences on one side or the other of these issues. Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Caldwell joins us now. He's a senior lecturer in psychology and part of the Center for Law, Society, and Justice at UW-Madison. He's also a senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison, where he's provided risk assessments. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
You do clinical risk assessments in your work. Can you tell us how that differs from these algorithm risk assessments we were just hearing about?
Well, a clinical risk assessment is based on the clinician's experience and their understanding of the current research. So it's not as mechanical as the algorithms that are used, and the person has to be very up to date on the current research, and also their methodology has to be guided by what's known from the research.
What kind of things are part of the latest research when it comes to evaluating whether someone, if they're released from an institutional setting, a correctional setting, is going to put other people at risk?
Well, that's a complicated question because no two people are exactly alike. A lot of people who have alcohol or drug problems are higher risk, for example. But, of course, somebody who is into a good recovery program and is working that well may not be. And age plays a big role in people's tendency to do antisocial behavior and criminal behavior. And then there's just all kinds of things around what kind of a setting is the person going back to? Do they have family support that's going to help them or hurt them? Are they in a situation where they can get a job and housing and all those kinds of things? So it's a pretty complicated set of factors that come together.
How much concern is there that racial bias can creep into, first of all, these kinds of in-person clinical assessments?
There should be quite a bit of concern on the clinical end, and also on when it comes to these algorithms mm-hmm. as well. One of the things, of course, you look at is the person's behavior pattern over time. But as we know, different jurisdictions enforce laws in different ways, and we want that. We have local prosecutors elected, and they have different, slightly different ways they handle certain cases. And so you have to be somewhat familiar with all of that and kind of take that into mind, into consideration as you go. But we also know, of course, that all of the information you're relying on, whether it's research in a clinical assessment or whether it's a actuarial or algorithm type of risk assessment, it's all based on information from a number of years ago, maybe 10 or 20 years ago. That's when you originally code the information. That's the foundation for the assessment. And we know that there's been a number of biases built into the system, kind of woven into the system, without even being, at times without it being deliberate. And so if you take a model and it's a pretty accurate description of how things worked, say, 20 years ago, and you apply it today, it's going to work the way it did 20 years ago. And if you want to do things better than we did 20 years ago, you're going to have to vary from that model in some ways. And it's not always 100% clear what's the best way to vary from that model.
Do you see it as possible that we can come up with some sort of algorithm system, whatever that might look like, that does help filter out some of the bias? Or are we doomed to, I don't know, garbage in, garbage out in that kind of system?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it's possible to mitigate some of the bias built into these systems, but I think more often you're in a situation where you have to apply these structured risk assessments in something other than a mechanistic way. You have to recognize that there's some bias built into them, and things have changed over time. And also, one of the other characteristics of these algorithms is that it's much easier to code static variables in the person's history. It's much easier to collect information on how many times they've been arrested or what kinds of crimes they've been arrested for than it is to quantify personal change. How much has the person changed since they were last arrested? That's a tough one to nail down because people change in different ways. And so these scales tend to be very insensitive to personal change. They tend to give you about the same risk today that they would have given you if you had scored them, 10 years ago. So they have to be, if they're going to be used and not do more harm than good, they have to be used in something other than a mechanistic way where the number, you get a certain number and that directly results in a certain outcome.
We're talking to Michael Caldwell, senior lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison, senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison. We're talking about risk assessment to determine if people can leave a correctional facility, a jail or prison, how these things work. And this, as we're hearing, the flaws that can sometimes end up even in algorithms that we hope will be impartial. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Anna in West Bend who couldn't stay on the line. Anna says her child's father was convicted for child molestation, sentenced to 30 years, was released 10 years early because of an algorithm and the pandemic. And Anna says it caused great trouble, concern for the families associated with him. Does that come up in these evaluations, the impact on past victims and maybe their concerns for the future for someone going through this kind of evaluation?
I don't know of any of the algorithms that specifically capture that. There's an indirect way that they may capture how serious the crime was that the person did, how much harm the victim experienced, in the sense that they may give more weight to, for example, violent crimes against the number of violent crimes against a person than and less weight to fewer violent crimes, but not very, nothing direct that I'm aware of in most of these algorithms. And again, a hard thing to capture how much harm the victim has experienced.
It seems like this goes way back in criminology and prison systems. The idea that we can come up with a scientific system that's going to help make our decisions for us when, as you say, every story is unique. Every person in the system is unique. Is this a circle we're never going to be able to square?
Well, I think we've gotten a little ways down the road. We're doing better than we did, say, 50 years ago. I don't think these algorithms and the actuarial measures that we're using are completely useless, but I do think they have to be well understood by the people that are using them, and especially the limitations that they present. As I mentioned, the change and the strength that the person brings to the situation, and actually, as the caller said, the potential harm, all those things need to be considered along with whatever the mechanistic score shows you.
One thing I wanted to ask about is transparency of these systems. Some of these risk assessment technology tools and algorithms are coming from private companies who don't always let everyone know, I guess, what goes into the process. How important is it to you that there's transparency? We know what goes into these decisions.
Yeah, that's transparency of privately developed scales is a serious problem. And I think the people that develop the scales would agree with that. They would say that the way that they develop the scale is proprietary information, just the same way that Google or Amazon might say that the way that their algorithms work is also private proprietary information. But what that means is that you can't have an independent check on how well that works, and especially you can't have an independent check on how should it apply to this particular individual. Is this person? All of these risk assessment scales work on the assumption that the person that you're evaluating pretty much matches the group that you use to develop the scale. And of course, there are exceptions to that. People who don't actually match, who have an unusual mental disorder or some other kind of unique characteristic that wasn't well represented in the original sample. So it's very difficult to pull that out or to examine that in these so-called black box scores.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Michael Caldwell, senior lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison and a senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison. He's with us today to talk about how risk assessments are used in the criminal justice system and the kinds of bias and transparency concerns there are in risk assessment technology, algorithms that are used at the state and federal levels.